Finance Committee will come to order. And we will, we do not have a quorum yet, so, but we're going to just get started, and then we'll take up business as we can once we get a quorum. First up, Davids, we have House File 3273. Before the committee this morning, and I understand you all have several testifiers.
Yes.
While we proceed. Welcome to the committee.
Chairman, House File 3273. If I could have someone, well, we can't move us in a member without a quorum, but just so the committee knows, on page 1, line 1.14, I'd like to match up the Senate bill with what they did, and on line 1.14, it said the Commissioner of Agriculture shall establish. And then it refers to commissioner, which will go back to line 1.14. So when we get to that point, Mr. Chairman, we want to make sure, we want to make clear which commissioner would go to.
Okay.
House File 3273 is a bill that would help promote a Minnesota grown product, if you will. It would appropriate some money to have soy-based transformer fluid conversion. It would start at soybean. Based transformer fluid conversion allowance program, which would promote the use of value-added product in Minnesota here. It would take soybeans, and it makes a very good transformer fluid. Right now, with the technology they have, it is a little higher price, but there are some obvious benefits to it. I have with me a Tom Johnson, who's the senior sales engineer, Cooper Power Systems, and then I have one other testifier, Jerry Schoenfeld. I believe on the agenda it says Jake Hamlin, too, but I'm looking at two folks who would like to testify for it. I'm not aware of any opposition at this point, and I'd also like to point out to the committee how important this fluid is. I have a list of partial, or a partial list of users of this product, and Mr. Chairman and members, I want you to know that George Mason University uses this product here, and I just want you to know what it's done for them. So hopefully it can do the same thing for the state of Minnesota. So with that, I'll turn it over to Tom Johnson with Cooper Power Systems.
Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself as the record.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Tom Johnson from Cooper Power Systems and a resident of Woodbury, Minnesota. I'm here today to support House File 3273 and review the soybean transformer fluid advantages. Minnesota is a national leader in soybean production and value-added uses of soybeans and a leader in renewable fuel technology. We have an opportunity to continue this tradition by being the first state to offer incentives for another renewable fuel product, soybean-based transformer fluid. To manufacture this transformer fluid, known in the marketplace as EnviroTemp FR3 fluid, soybeans are crushed, then seed oils, including soybean oil, are blended with food-grade performance-enhancing additives for the electrical characteristics needed to support the dielectric characteristics in a transformer. This results in an environmentally preferred, readily biodegradable product. Electrical transformers have utilized conventional mineral oil as a cost-effective dielectric coolant for over a century, the downside of mineral oil is quite obvious to the members of the committee, I'm sure, that it's a foreign source and it is not readily biodegradable. The background of mineral oil as a coolant in transformers also is it has a low fire point. Specifically 155 degrees C. What that low fire point is for mineral oil is that it can produce fires inside of a transformer at a very low temperature in comparison with what this particular fluid can do. That low fire point restricts the application of where you can put a mineral oil-filled transformer as well. Some background information, though. To address the mineral oil's low fire point in the 1970s, an alternative dielectric fluid included polychlorinated biphenyls, PCBs, combined with trichlorobenzene to be classified as a non-flammable fluid. This was one way that people were trying to get transformers into closer proximity. And as you know, the obvious downside of PCB fluid was that it was toxic and it was outlawed in 1976. Non-PCB fluids have since been developed with higher fire point, but they use costly synthetics. In our development at Cooper in the late 1990s, we discovered a natural ester-based formulation from soybean seeds which achieved the benefit of a less flammable fluid with a higher fire point, specifically 350 degrees C in comparison with the mineral oils 155 degrees C, so almost double, over double the fire point. We also discovered the benefit of soybeans was that it was a renewable resource, it was biodegradable, and it could extend transformer longevity. Specifically, the construction of a distribution transformer, an electrical transformer, is that it has a metal core coil assembly that the windings have a paper insulation that converts the power from a higher voltage to a lower voltage. This insulation is critical to the life of a transformer. In most cases, the transformer will fail due to a breakdown of that paper insulation. FR3 extends the paper insulation life 5 to 8 times. Thus, it extends the life of the asset for the electric utility, keeping the power on and the lines and the equipment on the system longer. Envirotemp FR3 also uses a base food-grade vegetable oil and is biodegradable in 21 days, based on testing done by the U.S. EPA. The EPA has also listed FR3 as part of the Environmental Technology Verification Program as an innovative environmental technology. Its biodegradability toxicity tests that the EPA uses, truck fries they call them, and basically the trout have to be able to survive when exposed to this particular fluid. And in this case, we're proud to say that there was zero mortality in the acute toxicity test, meaning that no trout were fried when exposed to FR3. So, again, FR3 does not contain petroleum, so the breakdown is almost complete within 21 days. Greater than 99% of the FR3 is broken down in that period of time. So, along with the excellent fire resistance qualities that have been recognized by listing testing laboratories such as UL and Factory Mutual, this has allowed for FR3 to be used in transformer installations both indoors and outdoors, and has allowed the utilities more flexibility with their installation. Currently in Minnesota, a number of municipal public utilities and rural electric cooperatives have purchased or are considering Envirotemp FR3 fluid. These utilities include Virginia, Grand Rapids, and New Ulm public utilities, People's Electric Co-op in Rochester, Rosa Electric, Red Lake, Steel Waseca, North Star Rural Electric Cooperatives have purchased FR3 fluid. To give some scope to this, this product, each year throughout the U.S., 75 million gallons of transformer fluid is used to retrofill or fill newly manufactured transformers. Our intent today is not to replace 75 million gallons of petroleum-based transformer fluid, but rather to create an increased awareness of the renewable, environmental, and performance-based benefits of soybean-based transformer fluid. FR3 is an innovative product that starts with the refined vegetable oil and undergoes further processing and treatment with additives to enhance the electrical properties only. So it's essentially soybean oil itself. Given the limited scope and small batch production process, this is a barrier to capturing the production economies that other non-bio-based fluids can achieve. A credit or an allowance will not create an economic advantage for soybean fluid over other non-bio-based fluids, but will help make the renewable oil more competitive for utilities to purchase the equipment filled with this fluid. Even with the adoption of this measure, natural ester fluids that are renewable will still need to compete against competitive counterparts in the marketplace. The grant is proposed to have a per-utility cap and a total gallon cap for all utilities, thereby limiting the fiscal impact. And the eligibility of the credit is available to utilities for a total of 18 months, concluding on January 1st, 2008. In conclusion, please continue Minnesota's tradition as a soybean and renewable leader by supporting this legislation. Thank you.
Okay. We have a quorum now, and so Representative Magnus moves that House File 3273 be before us. And I understand you have an amendment.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. If
you'd like to repeat that for us?
Yes, on page 1.14, subsection 2 establishment, the commissioner, and the amendment would be to add, of agriculture, shall establish, and I don't think we need to change it further on because when they do refer to commissioner, refer back to the commissioner of agriculture.
Okay. And do you have an appropriation amount that you want in the bill?
$240,000.
Okay, Representative Magnus moves those two amendments. Page 1, line 14, after commissioner, add of agriculture. And on page 2, line 13, insert $240,000. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion carries. Bill is amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My second witness is Mr. Jerry Schoenfeld, representing the Minnesota Soybean Producers.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Jerry Schoenfeld, Minnesota Soybean Growers Association. I'm just really here today to be in support of this particular bill because it does expand renewable uses for Minnesota product. Minnesota soybeans provide the third highest of all the commodities in the state, the third highest gross sales in Minnesota. They're a significant contributor to the state's economy. And we have never, to be honest, I don't think in all my years that I've represented them, I don't think we've ever actually come in and asked for a kind of a subsidy in terms of dollars before. We've worked with biodiesel, as you know, in the past, in which we asked the state to require it in the fuel, but we didn't have any dollars that went along with that. We've worked with soybean ink in the past, where in Minnesota, and I just wanted to mention that because it's one of those kinds of things where it did take state action to get it started, but it was a real success story in that in Minnesota, we back in the late 80s, had met with Governor Purvich at that time. He initially signed an executive order that said that it would be used, the soybean-based ink would be used by his administration. Later on, there was a bill that was introduced that expanded that for all state uses. Today, almost every newspaper in the country is printed with soybean ink. It was a real success story. My point of that is that it was initiated by some action on part of the state of Minnesota. The same is true with biodiesel. Minnesota was the first state in the country to enact that. Now Washington State has followed. The state of Illinois has provided tax incentives. There are other types of incentives throughout the nation. And soybean-based biodiesel is really taking off across the country, expected to be about 1.5 billion gallons, I think, by next year. So initiations by the state have been very helpful in the past. We think there are several things, I think, that our possibilities to help promote this. In this particular bill, it asks for the $240,000 to help promote this item. There may be some other ways. I think we all recognize that there's tight money this year in the budget, but we want to be in support of to get this idea ahead of you and recognize that whatever the state could do to help promote this is what we would ask you to do. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Here are the questions.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Magnus.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And just an additional comment. I know a lot of work has been put into this by the soybean checkoff, and I would testify to that, to the fact that a lot of the other states in the United States that are that are involved in the soybean checkoff and in production and membership in the Soybean Growers Association are closely watching what we do here in Minnesota. Not only what we've done in biodiesel, but other efforts we're looking at in ethanol promotion and the promotion of renewable products to replace the petroleum-based products we have. So one of the benefits we have by hearing, not only just hearing this bill, but hopefully as the bill moves forward, it's important for us to remember that other states are watching what we do. And I think it's good that Minnesota continues to be a leader in most of these efforts, and hopefully we can proceed ahead with the bill, Mr. Chairman and members, and make this a reality for us.
Okay. Other questions or comments? Okay, House File 3273 is laid over for possible inclusion in the agricultural supplemental bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members.
Thank you.
We have House File 3514, Representative Murphy. Well, Representative Murphy's coming forward, members, so we have 2 minutes before us. One is from March 28th. Representative Erdahl moved the minutes of March 28th. Are there any additions and corrections? All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevails. March 28th minutes are approved. Also have the minutes of March 29th. Our Representative Junkie moved the minutes of March 29th. Are there any additions or corrections? All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevails. Minutes are approved. Representative Murphy, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm here to speak on behalf of House File 3514. Last year, last session, there was a transfer of at least $6 million in income from royalties from mining under state mineral leases to the DNR. I believe that this is contrary to the 1851 charter for the University of Minnesota, which requires that these funds be paid into the permanent university trust fund. And I believe that it is inconsistent with the provisions of Minnesota Statutes 137.022, which sets forth how the income from this fund is to be used, including the Natural Resources Research Institute for mineral and mineral-related research, endowed scholarships, and endowed faculty chairs at the U. House File 3514 pays back to the Permanent School Fund and the Permanent University Trust Fund the money that was taken out last year. And I provided Ms. Brick with a worksheet that came from Kathy Lewis from the DNR that shows the split of the funding. And then on the other side of that worksheet is a from Senate Finance worksheet. And Kathy Lewis from the DNR is here to answer questions if we need it. And so is Peter Sederberg from the university.
Are there any questions of Representative Murphy? I think Representative Gill will move House File 3514 to get it before us. And if we could have someone from DNR come up. Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. I'm Kathy Lewis with the Lands and Minerals Division, DNR.
If you could tell us, is this a good idea?
Mr. Chair, historically the revenue for minerals management of the school trust fund, university trust fund, and other lands has been paid out of the general fund. Last year, the governor and the legislature were looking at a difficult budget situation, and the decision was to have the funds that receive the income bear the management costs that generate so that the funds that are receiving income actually are going to bear the management costs. There has been an Attorney General's advice memo saying that this is a legal action, and so it was a just difficult decision, but it is one that was taken in light of the budget situation, only for a two-year period at this point in time. It would be revisited again next biennial budget.
Okay. Are the dollars that have been set aside into the general fund from this activity been exceeded the amount that was needed to manage those lands?
Mr. Chair, the money that goes into the account has to be appropriated by the legislature. So the legislature appropriated $2,046,000 each of the 2 years. The funding that's gone in so far is $2.8 million. And we have another quarter coming in for the year. So the amount of money generated this year will exceed the amount appropriated. And we anticipate the same thing will happen next year. The amount that's left in the fund that exceeds $3 million gets distributed back to the school and the university.
Okay. Right. Are there questions? President Murphy.
Mr. Chair, I have a question, and I just want to pose the question. I don't need an answer. Ms. Lewis said that it was a legal action taken by the legislature last year, and I don't doubt that it is. But is it a morally correct decision to take money from scholarships and students and research for management?
Well, Representative Murphy, if the land isn't managed, how is it supposed to earn dollars?
I think what Representative Murphy is saying, that the way the money was taken is the problem. The history of this, the history of these lands is that the money was appropriated from the general fund to manage the land. There was never a lack of management of the land. It's just where the money came from. And the Range delegation was unanimously against that action and voted accordingly. Most of the money comes from timber and iron mining. There's hundreds of millions of dollars in the PUF fund, Permanent University Fund, and the School Trust Fund, and it continues to grow. And we just objected, considering the however long the number of years was that the money came from the general fund, that suddenly we would shift gears and change state policy of how we operate just because we're a little short on money, and then take it from the kids and from research to do those things. So that, I think that's how we felt about it, and we'd like to see it go back to the way it was. And I'm certain that at some point in the future it will go back to that. But we think it should be sooner than later.
And Representative Joe, I understand that the timing of the decision was because of the financial situation the state was in. But as far as the principle behind it of having the lands, the proceeds from the land first pay for its management and then having the excess or the profits act going to the cause, why should the rest of the taxpayers pick up that management rather than the proceeds from that land?
Well, because, Mr. Chair, the proceeds are going to the taxpayers. All of the proceeds are going to the taxpayers in the form of scholarships, in the form of money that goes to NRRI and the Coleraine Minerals Laboratory. All of those things benefit and enhance the opportunity for the use of minerals, so we can do it more efficiently, and the use of wood to keep the copy paper machines running around here, and the different types of use. And it just seems to me that on occasion when our checkbook gets a little short, that we change policy rather than, that's always the first thing to be changed, is change policy. And I don't know how many years, maybe Ms. Lewis could answer, how many years that the general fund has paid for that management. My recollection is that it's decades upon decades. But that's a question for Ms. Lewis, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
Representative Dill, the general fund until this year paid for all the management costs for mineral leasing activities on school trust fund lands. There's been an exception for the university lands previously that the legislature did enact in one time, but then it repealed it the next year.
Mayor, follow up.
Representative Dill.
And how, just for the committee, when did we get the land? So when I ask you the question, I'm trying to think back that it was about was somewhere around 18 after the Civil War.
Mr. Chair, Representative Deal, the school trust fund lands were granted to the state when we became a union, 1858. The university lands date back to 1851 with the formal grant. There's two grants. One was in 18. Formally came over in 1858. The other one is 1870.
Mr. Chair, one more follow-up, please, if you would.
Thank you.
During the Carlson administration, there was a budget deficit, as I recall from my memory. One of the years that we raised the sales tax 0.5%
temporarily
to fix the LGA problem, if you remember those days, members. What happened to the PUF money management going to the same money? Was there a diversion of the money away from the general fund for payment of your services, or did we continue up until just now, this last year, and then change our policy?
Mr. Chair, Representative Deal, the 1995 legislation created a suspense account that was repealed in 1996, and then in 1996 there was reduction in appropriation from the university lands and the minerals suspense account and replacement. So that's the history I have in front of me.
That's it, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
And do you agree with the, we have a sheet here that shows that to change this, would put what type of hole in the general fund? $7 million?
Mr. Chair, yes. This is an estimate because, of course, you don't have fiscal year 07 revenue, but it would be an estimate of $7,028,000 at this point in time.
And during that period of time, what is the cost of actually managing those lands?
Mr. Chair, the money that's been appropriated is $2.46 million for each of fiscal years 06 and 07. That's for minerals management costs, and it also included $100,000 to accelerate some environmental review work for new mineral projects, and also $420,000 each year to enhance further development of mineral projects. So it's a combination, the $2,046,000 is a combination of three projects there for the DNR.
Okay. So there's essentially a profit of a little over $3 million?
Mr. Chair, the estimate is that at the end of the biennium, there would be about $3,188,000 left. $188,000 would be distributed between the university and school funds. The $3 million would be carried forward. The concept of the minerals management account is that there are good times in mining and there are bad times in the mining industry, and that the account would be there in the future to tap for continuing the mineral management activities by the DNR so that you build up an account to handle the bad times as well as when the good times are there, the excess is distributed.
And Representative Murphy, the proposal on this bill would just be that the general fund would pick up all the management costs. Is that correct?
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
And then, so then everything that this comes off the in the form of profits would then go to the two funds.
Yes.
Okay. It doesn't seem like a very fair way for have all of us. We're taking money from one thing to pay for another, so we know the $4 million is going to come out of the general fund. It means there's $4 million of other things that are not being funded. Why the schools are, this particular fund should be held harmless on with regard to management, I'm not quite sure. Maybe you can help me understand that.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'm not quite sure why it was decided to take the money out in the first place, when historically we've always paid for the management. out of the general fund and why they went into this fund. I don't, you know, I wasn't part of the negotiations. My senator was, and he's carrying the bill in the Senate. And the part that I'm upset and a few of my constituents have conveyed to me are they're upset is that the money is no longer available for the university and for the scholarships and for the school trust fund. And I just think taking the money for management that's historically coming, it came from the general fund out of the scholarship money and the chair money and the trust fund money was a bad decision. And it was, you know, it was done in a conference committee, so I was, and I certainly, I didn't follow it. I have to admit that.
Okay.
But then it was in, it wasn't even, it was part of the jobs bill in the end, and where there wasn't a lot of debate even.
We had that bill before us, committee. We debated it here, the full committee.
And I'm not saying it wasn't that everybody wasn't conscious of it, but I wasn't conscious of it. And so I didn't have the opportunity to speak out, and so the bill is here.
Representative Cornyn.
Mr. Chair, members, that was my bill last year that did this. I didn't know that when we walked in. We were talking about your bill up today. But at the time when we came to the table, the reason was, the reasoning behind it was find a stable source of funding and a funding that was derived from what was actually going on. It seemed a good choice to connect the funding to the source. And actually, we talked about it here, and I didn't hear a lot of squawking from the range delegation about this on the floor or anywhere else either. I was never really... You know, a big outcry went out against it. It went through a couple of committees out in the open. We did talk about it here. But it seemed to make sense because it gave them a stable source of funding, one you didn't have to count on, you know, the general fund every year, and it came out of the source. So it seemed like a good idea at the time. And we knew that it was going to go up and down, the funding, that there would be fat years and lean years, depending on how the industry went. But and also it was going to be used to enhance minerals management for to actually make a better system, make it more available and more productive. So it had good intentions. It wasn't meant as a hostile takeover of the trust account.
Just to refresh memories, this issue was a little controversial. As I recall, it went to both the Education Committee and Higher Education Committee as well as this committee.
Mm-hmm.
People were aware of that.
And one last comment.
Representative.
This is not just because the trees grow up in northern Minnesota and just because the iron ore is up in Minnesota. That has nothing to do with how the funds operate, the PUF fund or the school trust fund. That money is dispersed all over the state to kids that are in every town, that go to every state university, and every single school that is in every single school district gets money from this. So by taking the money from the away from the funding of the research away from the mineral away from the general fund and taking it from the proceeds, we have lessened the ability for the corpus to grow and create more income to be distributed to more families all across Minnesota. And our main objection was again that since 18 whenever with a couple of minor bobbles we have done, this state has operated under that policy prior to this last legislation. And to give you an example, the impact of this. the $100,000 that Ms. Lewis referred to work on some environmental issues was the $100,000 that got Mesaba Nugget over the hump. And so now we're going to have a new generation of we went from raw hematite mining to taconite mining in 1958, and now we're going to be making Mesaba nuggets, which is 98% plus pure steel. that is going to greatly benefit these two funds and greatly benefit every single K through 12 student in the state and every single student that goes to a university and thousands of students who receive first year scholarships. I believe they're $1,000 a piece from the same funds that we just took away from the corpus. So I understand when times get tough, we do things that we don't want to do. But sometime, and maybe today isn't the day, we need to get back on track to how we did it. And that's my last statement on this issue. Thank you.
And
I'm like Forrest Gump. That's all I have to say about that.
Representative, just so you know that this chair, for one anyway, actually thought that the change in policy was the correct thing to do, because those $4 million that are used to manage it, this program, does not grow on trees. And so it conversely takes away from $4 million off the top when we're trying to disperse monies for education or nursing homes or other things out of the general fund. It makes the general fund $4 million less. And so it's not like this is free money, and it just kind of grows on trees. And to have the identification of where the money is coming from and have it focused on these accounts makes it more visible, and I think actually makes the management more critical, because we pay more attention to the management of these lands if we actually know what is being shorted when these lands do not earn the dollars that they should be earning. When they're not getting maximum return, then we know for sure that these are the accounts that are, and the management costs are going up. They're actually taking money from these accounts. That, to me, is more accountability than when it's just taking money from the general fund. But the what I'd like to really appreciate from the DNR is if we could get a little history as to the cost of the management of these lands over time. As I suspect, this was probably not a conscious decision by the legislature as to how the lands or where the money was coming from to manage them, but it probably just gradually grew over time and has now reached a substantial amount where it probably started out being very minuscule. But I'd like to get some historical perspective on this, if I could, see where this policy, supposed policy that we're changing, actually came from. With that, we will lay House File 3514 over for possible inclusion in the supplemental bill. Representative Murphy.
I was going to ask if you have, in your previous discussions, if Mr. Sederberg from the university had spoken and talked about the use of the funding.
I believe that we did have testimony of that nature. I don't think there's any question about the use of the wanting to get more money into those funds. That's not really the question. It's where the money will come from to manage those lands to create the revenues for the fund. And who pays for that management? Does it come out of the general fund where all taxpayers are paying for it, or do we pay for it out of the profits of those lands? That's really the discussion.
And the student.
Okay.
Thank
you very much.
Thank you for the latitude to talk about this, because it is a pretty high priority, and we did have a pretty fair controversy about it, Representative Cornish, in other committees, and especially in the closed doors of the Iron Range delegation.
That's what I was going to say, Representative Kerr. It must have been in this committee. I remember you saying it was going to be a controversy, we should send it to Ed, and I wasn't there when they went over their omnibus, so maybe a controversial effort left me.
You came to forget what you want.
All right.
Thank you for your attention.
You're very welcome. Thank you. Representative Magnus.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Today is, members, today is FFA Day, and we have a fine group of FFA members from Chaska here this morning. I'd like to welcome them.
Welcome to the committee. We're going to have House File 3457, Representative Peterson. Representative Peterson moves House File 3457.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We're deciding if who's got handouts and who doesn't. Do you have the same thing?
We have two that we're handing out here.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Today we're discussing potential appropriation to the Commissioner of Agriculture, MDA, for what's referred to as productive conservation. This idea has been growing in support and has been discussed with the Department of Agriculture. I think there's a general sense of support from the department, but timing wasn't such that it got into the governor's recommendations. I have two people with me here today to describe what this bill would do at the department, along with the RCNDs across Minnesota and NRCS, USDA, and all the things we talk about in committee regarding conservation, somewhat renewable energy, and how do you say, leveraging federal money from USDA under farm bills and other type of things. Starting off today will be Sheila Barsness from the Westman RC&D up in Alexandria, and then after that, Dennis Gibson from the Minnesota Agroforestry Co-op Group. So, go ahead.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
Please identify yourself for the record.
My name is Sheila Barsness, and I work with Westman RC&D in Alexandria, Minnesota. And I just want to say thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, for allowing me the opportunity to talk to you about House File 3457. Productive conservation on working lands is a project that the RC&Ds have been working on for more than 4 years now. And it derived from the renewable energy projects that we've been working on for the last 12 to 15 years. Basically, our concept is to provide sustainable economic opportunities while offering the environmental benefits to the state of Minnesota without idling the land. By working with willing landowners who want to grow and demonstrate new crops on their land, offering crop establishment payments, technical assistance, market development, on-farm research, revolving loan funds for long-term crops, to reduce the risk to landowners wanting to grow conservation and renewable energy crops. Similar programs throughout the state include the Conservation Reserve Enhancement Program, or CREP, and the CRP program. Those programs offer the environmental benefits, the state and federal partnerships. They're results-orientated, and they're flexible within their parameters. The concerns that we've been hearing from the constituents that we work with throughout the state has been with the perpetual easements with the CREP and the limited economic opportunities after the initial payments and the RIM payments are paid out. The land sits idle, and the economic concerns after those programs, the financial period of those programs end, has a lot of the county commissioners that we work with and a lot of the landowners who sign up for these programs that they sign up wanting those payments and not thinking further ahead what they're going to do after the payments end. Productive conservation has the same similar benefits to the CRP and CREP program. It offers environmental benefits. It's a state, federal, and local partnership. Basically, we're results-orientated, flexible within our parameters, but we're adding renewable energy opportunities, value-added opportunities, and we're serving the underserved areas of the state as well. So we've tried to provide balance to the current conservation programs by adding the economic impact and ensuring the economic viability to the landowners in the state of Minnesota. We're not saying that idle conservation programs are bad. They've done exactly what they're supposed to do. They've contributed to the improved water quality, the reduction of commodity crops, and improved environmental conditions of wildlife. Again, we just want to add to the economic viability. Possible or potential productive conservation crops include hybrid poplars, switchgrass, willows, kufia, other non-food energy crops. We don't want to state individual crops. We want them to be based on the economic, environmental, and social benefits that they would have to the state. And that would be determined by the Productive Conservation Technical Advisory Committee that would be formed under this agreement. The landowners and the farmers that currently want to grow productive conservation crops or want to try new industry are faced with no new industry that's currently developed yet. And we can't get new industry to develop without producers wanting to grow the crops. So it's the whole chicken before the egg concept. And this, our proposal, proposes crop establishment payments, market development, and research development. So we have the holistic approach to make all efforts work. And the continued interest from private industry and the individual RC&D projects throughout the state lead us to believe that the time is right for this initiative. Also, the governor's support of the 25 by 25, so that all types of our energy will come from renewable sources by 2025, leads us to believe that this is the perfect time for this. The federal legislators that support our efforts, Senator Coleman's office and Congressman Peterson's office and Congressman Gutnick's office, have been looking for changes for the 2007 Farm Bill. And they're looking for Minnesota to take a lead and to show interest in an alternative farm program. And that's why we're here today.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If I could have one more on Dennis Gibson to describe more of, I think, the productive conservation and the ground truth as to what we're talking about here. So, Dennis, if you want to come on in and let the community know about your...
I had a handout, but I'm having a little trouble getting it handed out. I'm Dennis Gibson from Montevideo. Is there any reason why we can't handle that?
Other than we didn't know about it.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
I'm from Montevideo, and I live in a community that's 4 miles too far south, and I just want to tell you why I say that, because when I was up to Benson, Minnesota, I picked up their daily paper yesterday, and it's from Wilmer, and they have a new project going on up there. It's called Fibromin. It's turkey litter to electricity, a biomass energy conversion plant. The other thing is that I find of somewhat interest is that Benson, Minnesota was described in the State of the State address of the governor's, a small western Minnesota community town of 3,300, Benson, Minnesota. And that is kind of associated with his endorsement of the 25-25 project. And so he highlighted that community. And it almost encourages me to move the 4 miles north so I can say I'm from Benson rather than from Montevideo. In the handout that I just picked some things out of my file that I thought were kind of intriguing to me, and so I'm bringing them to you. And one of the meetings that we had in initiating this program was meeting with the Department of Agriculture, and if you'll just scan the list of names that attended that, the attempt there was to find a partnership with the University of Minnesota to work on productive conservation crops. And one of the contentious moments was, what is a productive conservation crop? And so out of that meeting came the definition that Sheila gave you, that it has to be economically sustainable, environmentally useful, and socially beneficial.
The other RC&D project that I was a part of in a very, very much of its infancy, and it moved around and it moved to International Falls, Minnesota. That's the second page. It's called RECAP, Renewable Energy Clean Air Project. And that kind of was made public on September 6th, and so that project is going forward. That is primarily, to my dismay, is to take municipal solids and converting it to electricity and then plugging into the backside of Boise Cascade and using the energy in place. But nonetheless, it's a renewable energy project, and I'm quite excited about the process. The next two pages just are some frequently asked questions about that project, and the one that I find useful to me is that in the conversion, they're really converting it to syngas, which then could be converted to other products that I use on the farm, like anhydrous, the future of hydrogen, and those kinds of things. So the RC&D consoles have within their organization concepts that are being built by their direction. When the next page on devolution, myself and a few other farmers have attended, been out to Washington for the last 3 years or 3 to 4 years ago. We even met with Aaron when he was a staffer out there. So we're starting to have some time on this, and one of the Energy Research Service, I believe is the name of the USDA cousin, has a bulletin called Amber Waves, and in that they describe devolution, and I really think that I like it because it fits what the RC&D mission is about. It means that you don't create a program in Washington or in St. Paul and administer it. You empower communities to solve their own problems from the ground up, create their programs, and start to do problem solving out where people identify the problem and kind of know how to fix it with a little help. And when I started out, I was talking about the community of Benson. And so yesterday I scooted up there and I talked to the mayor, and he gave me a letter of support. I'll just read it for you because I think it's short and very good. I'm writing in favor of this biomass legislation. I was unable to be there for the hearings to testify in favor of the bills being considered. Here in Benson, the ethanol plant, CVAC, that stands for Chippewa Valley Ethanol Co-op, is in the process of revamping so they can use biomass as an energy source for their plants. Natural gas cost them $20 million last year. They are looking for a cheaper source of energy. The Fiberman plant in our city will burn turkey litter, but will also burn other forms of biomass. This scenario is happening all across the state and nation, but it's really happening in Benson, Minnesota. I believe that it is important to research and develop different forms of biomass, but even more important it is to demonstrate that farmers can grow them and make a profit doing so. Very few, if any, farmers can afford to dedicate a large portion of their land to experiment with alternative biomass crops without some help. I believe that especially in these times, it is up to the government, universities, industry, and the farmers to demonstrate that biomass is a viable alternative to fossil fuels. It can only happen if these entities work together. Paul Kettleson, the mayor of Benson. Another group that I'm trying to coordinate with the city of Benson is MINVAP, the Minnesota Valley Alfalfa Producers, and the president of that co-op had recently wrote a letter to Colin Peterson asking for support through this program to get considered planted status on their grower's land to grow alfalfa. Because if you grow alfalfa by farm service agency, you get a zero history on your farm. If you get enough zeros, you're in the zero column. Lois Brown is here with me today, and she's behind me.
Okay.
And she's a researcher, and has worked extensively with the hazelnut crop. And the hazelnut crop is interesting to me because about 20 years ago I was asked to come along and testify for a group, and Willard Munger was here. When the person got up to talk about hazelnuts, the room kind of lit up. And they were all so interested in the hazelnut production. And I highlight that just because LCMR has been funding this research for quite a lengthy time. And I believe it's just on the verge of becoming a mature crop. There is a group in Rochester, Minnesota that I think is emerging that probably in their rolling land, it really has a home in that area to get some perennialized crops in those valleys. So I think that's one of the emerging crops that we need to support that puts a safety net under farmers so that they can produce it on a large enough scale that it has environmental benefits rather than a backyard hobby. Lois sent me yesterday a support letter, and I would like you to go to the second page of that, and I'd like to read the last paragraph there for you, because I thought she just she had to do it on her own, and all of these statements are people on their own, and I thought she just slam-dunked it in the last paragraph, and it's short. Many Minnesota farmers are hesitant to grow anything but corn and soybeans because they have the equipment for corn and soybeans, and those are what they know. Programs are needed to allow them to experiment with alternative crops like perennial grasses, poplar, hazelnuts, without bearing all of the risk themselves. I hope that you will work with Congress to fund such programs and thereby lead us to greater energy self-sufficiency at the same time as benefiting the environment. Lois Brown. Thank you, Lois. The next page is from the research at ARS, and they are growing kufia, and it's a new emerging crop. It's a seed that's out of the wild. Millions of dollars have been spent on its, in my opinion, millions of dollars have been spent in developing this crop. But there is a disconnect from the emergence of a new crop produced by the government to get it out in the field for applied research. And that page on alternative crops I took out of their files. They sent their farmer staff, or their cooperators, to Washington last year to lobby to get $300,000 for coordination. And what I find, what dismays me, is the fact that farmers can participate in this first initial seed production. And I know a man by the name of Chuck Walters is on the regional partnership at the University of Minnesota, and he said last year, I grew some kufia, and it cost me $2,000 to participate. I'm kind of losing interest. I don't think I'll grow it next year. And I feel that this is wrong. If people are experimenting with leading universities and researchers, we should have a vehicle in which to participate that doesn't put us at risk. Or some of these things don't happen. And we need to work with these people, because when corporate America comes and helps us, we come up with names that ring in our ears. One of them is Jerusalem artichokes. Some of you may know that crop and its the discomfort it brought to our community. The last one I have there is from...
We have a question here, Representative.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Gibson. I think that it's a very worthwhile project and I'd like to see it proceed. I had a session with Mr. Gibson where he went through this with me and Senator Dill. But one question that some of us have over here, you've mentioned copia. Is this a woody plant, a grass? What is it? Would you describe that to us, please?
Okay. Copia is a... it's an annual crop. It's a small oilseed crop. It's a non-food crop. It's not meant for the human digestive tract. It produces lauric acid, which is used in cosmetics, soaps, and in airplane hydraulic fluid because of its ability to stay liquid under extremely cold temperatures. And so it's a product that's being imported into the United States, comes in the form of coconut oil, and it has a kind of a premium price, and so they have taken it on as a project, and this is a crop, is a seed that grows in the wild. It's a far distant cousin of the loosestrife family, and its nature in growing is most ideally suited in our climatic and our soil type. And so this is why Morris, Minnesota was chosen out of all the ARS labs to get it out into the field. And they're making projections they would like to see, I don't know, some 300,000 acres or such thing. So there is a need for it. There is a market for it. They've entertained a North Carolina company working with Procter & Gamble to be holding the hands of the agricultural community in developing the market. And this concerns me because I think the future for Kufia isn't for agriculture, it's for people on the East Coast.
One quick follow-up. Mr. Gibson, now... since I don't know anything about this, is it like a tree, plant, a bush? What is it?
It looks like a soybean plant. You grow it in rows, and I think it's... I don't know much about it either. But I have worked with Abdullah Jaradat, and he's so proud of this, and he's trying to promote it. And I think it's a perfect RC&D flop. The USDA cousins to get together, one to provide the seed, the other cousin to develop the coordination to get that crop in the community so that Minnesota can benefit from it. And I think that's where our opportunity lies.
Thank you. Any other questions? I think one thing Dennis told me a couple months ago was, you know, what is the value of 20-year-old grass? You know, that maybe it's filtering and providing water slowing down on the land and those types of things, and it's in a CRP or a continuous CRP, or it's in CREP, but it's not perpetual, and then you add some rim to it, and it's functioning, but there could be more going on that piece of ground. This part then is called by this group productive conservation, so you can get a little bit more out of it rather than just idling it, if you will. I think it's good for the state here, I believe, and the Senator Sams and Representative Westrum as well have been helping us along with the Department of Ag and with all these interconnected groups over many jurisdictions, federal, state, and local, to get a statement made, at least, to say that we are working on this so we can tell our congressional delegation that we are definitely interested in the department, we have the attention of, and when you rewrite the next farm bill, you should consider that Minnesota is a worthy place to spend some money on productive conservation, because clearly Mr. Gibson has traveled the entire state and is an advocate for more than just Benson, even though it's growing and most visible there right now.
Thank you very much. House File 3457 be laid over for possible inclusion in the agricultural supplemental bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Thank you.
The Representative McNamara, House File 3116.
2.5 million. Good morning, Mr. Chair. House File 3116 is the Omnibus Game and Fish Bill, and Mr. Bogus from DNR is here to help present the bill. And I guess I need somebody to move the bill, Mr. Chair.
Representative Magnus moves House File 3116. Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think I'll turn it over to Mr. Bogus to run through a synopsis of the bill.
Mr. Chair and members, I thought I would highlight for the committee the sections of the bill that relate to some fiscal issues or that have fiscal implications. I see Mr. Helen has produced a good summary of the bill. So I'll mention those sections, and then I believe it's the pleasure of the chair if you want me to run through all the sections of the bill or
just the ones that are pertinent.
Okay. I think the first one is Section 9 of the bill, which expands the types of donations that can be accepted for the Critical Habitat Program. Currently, we can accept land, interest in land, or cash contributions. This would allow acceptance of any property of value that they could then be liquidated by the commissioner and used for the purposes of the program. We have some technical changes in Section 17 that relate to deposit of various receipts in the Game and Fish Fund, clarifying some authorities and some language on how the money actually gets credited to those accounts. Section 18 of the bill eliminates some language that is a provision that allows for use of Game and Fish dollars to pay for the cost of keeping prisoners who are being held for violation of the Game and Fish laws. And we haven't used Game and Fish dollars for that purpose for 30 years or so, but there's a provision in statute. It used to say that the commissioner shall use Game and Fish money for that. We had a federal aid audit about 4 years ago where the federal auditors identified that as a potential diversionary use of hunting and fishing license dollars, so we had the law amended to say the commissioner may instead of shall, and we just went through another audit, and the auditors still have a problem with that language with the word may, so this bill would just eliminate that language, but the local governments still keep half the fine money from those fines, so we're not aware of any opposition to that, and it would help address a federal aid audit issue. Section 19 clarifies deposit of portions of the deer license revenue. Part of this is technical and part of it is a substantive change to make the additional 50 cents that was dedicated in the to make the 50 cents that was dedicated in the mid-1990s for deer feeding and later was expanded to CWD management and then even later was expanded to servant health management. Since that provision was enacted in the mid-1990s, the department has interpreted that to be part of the dollar of the deer license that's dedicated for deer management, computerized licensing. Our Citizens Budget Oversight Committee believes that the proper interpretation of that should have been that was an additional 50 cents out of the existing deer license fee. And so we're agreeable to making the change in the law to correspond with their desired interpretation. And then Section 24 of the bill would authorize the youth firearms deer license. This is the half-price license that was created, I think, 3 years ago now for youth under the age of 18. This would provide for that license to be valid in any of the regular firearms zones or time periods. Right now, the youth have to pick a zone, and we do have a number of youth who have foregone the half-price license and instead purchased multi-zone licenses, which are double the cost of a a regular license or all-season licenses, which are triple the cost of a regular license, so that they could help with their parent or guardian in more areas of the state. So by making this change, it would allow them to do that type of thing on their regular JIR license, but it would have some fiscal impact because they would no longer have a need to purchase those. Likely most of them would no longer purchase those multi-zone or all-season licenses that are more expensive. So we've estimated that if all of them that are currently purchasing those higher-priced multiple-zone licenses were to discontinue that practice, that this would have an impact of about $150,000 a year in revenue to the Game and Fish Fund. However, all deer license sales are currently generating over $20 million a year in revenue, and we feel that this is a relatively small loss of revenue to invest in the future of deer hunters and deer hunting. Those are the provisions of the bill, Mr. Chairman, that relate to fiscal issues.
Okay. Questions on the bill? Gripson Magnus.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I don't want to open up a can of worms here, but under the off-road and all-terrain vehicles, page 3, line 3.1, really, I'm looking at, and it's my understanding the Class 2 all-terrain vehicles would be like a Gator or something like that. And my question is, a person under the age of 16 should know how to operate this, and my concern, representing American America, is that I think we still have farm permits out in the country, and so farm kids can drive a vehicle down the road at age 15 for sure. I mean, I did it when I was 14. I think it was back when I was, like South Dakota is, and I'm not sure we want to put in an age of 16 that can't operate that vehicle when they're 15 years old. They can drive a truck or a vehicle down the road if they have the farm permit.
Mr. Chair, this is Representative Hackbart's issue and main interest. Maybe I could defer to him.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Magnus, if you look at the beginning of the section, we're talking about on public rights of way. On the farm, it'll be okay on private property. This is actually Representative Pennis's bill that we rolled into this bill, and it's about on public right of way, not on private property.
Well, again, Mr. Chairman, my point is you have a farm permit, you can drive a car or truck down the road, down the highways, and in some cases you may have these folks driving it down the right of way, but it's just a question I have. I don't know if we want to restrict that to at least 18 years of age, or 16, I mean.
Any other questions on the bill? Or did you get your question answered?
I think we may have to look at it later on.
Other questions?
Mr. Chair, more of an observation. For some reason, it seems like this Game and Fish Bill this year has just been, it's not moving along that way. I can't put my finger on what it would be. I don't, just an observation.
It's just not hopping along, huh?
Does that have anything to do with, Mr. Chair and members, does that have anything to do with who was the author for the three previous years, Representative Hopper?
Could be. Are we just on those items that he testified on, or are we on the entire bill, Mr. Chairman?
Representative Gill, on the bill, there's anything in the bill, and then we'll go to amendments.
I was looking at, I had a question on it, and now I lost it because I was flipping it. I tend to agree, Mr. Chairman. I sure do. I think I co-authored the Pennis bill, but that 16 does seem to be a bit problematic that Representative Magnus was referring to. I think I see a lot of heads shaking around here. Can't we just do a verbal amendment and change that?
Mr. Chair, just to that point, looking at the language, none of that was changed. Only the underline is the new language. That six, that age was already in statute the way it looks to me. It's not underlined. It's not changed. So I don't know how far back it goes. I mean, they're just changing some wordage here and the number of passengers, but the language was already there. So it was a real minor change to a statute. I just want to point that out, that this whole section isn't new. It's been there for a while. I don't know how long.
But Mr. Chairman, doesn't this have...
Doesn't mean we can't change it, but, you know, it's a policy-type thing issue, and this is a finance committee, so, I mean, I'm just kind of throwing that out.
Mm-hmm.
I might agree with the change, too, but...
Chair, we didn't have Class 2 language in here previously, and...
No.
We got the...
And what is it that you're looking at trying to change?
3.1 on page 3, line 3.1. I'm thinking along the lines of Representative Magnus, and I see Representative Hackbart kind of shaking his head. Maybe he agrees to just change that to 15 from 16. I mean, it is true that, if you have a child with a farm permit, they can drive a... Correct. Pickup truck or a car or anything else all the way to town and pick up feed and grain and everything else. They might be needing the Class 2 ATV to go from the barn to haul some diesel fuel out to a combine or, you know, to go pick up a sick, he might be trapping beaver or something, doing the state some good under the supervision of Representative Cornish.
Well,
so you're referring...
I make a motion then to amend that line 3.1 to read a person under 15 years of age.
Representative McNamara.
Well, Mr. Chair, Ray Bowen from the ATV group is here, and I think Representative Dill, if I could interject, maybe he could bring how we deal with it on ATVs, and I think your logic of how these vehicles may be construed, President Magnus, to be safer, less chance of tipping over and stuff. Maybe we should hear how we deal with ATVs and operators under the age of 16 to give us just some real quick background, Mr. Chair.
Well, let's see if there's any controversy on it first. If the motion is to change it from 16 to 15, is there objection to making that move?
No. Mr. Chair, I have no objection. I think it's a good idea. But to do that, I don't know how this would work. Would it only be if they had the permit to drive a vehicle, or would it a regular car or truck, or doesn't that matter? I don't care. I think it's a good idea, but...
Well, Mr. Chairman, my intent isn't to tie it to that.
Okay. I think it's a good idea.
Is there any discussion in opposition to the motion to change on page 3, line 1, change the 16 to 15? Okay. Motion occurs on... As stated, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevails. Bill is amended.
Mr. Chair, another item on page 15. I had a question on line 1. I'm sorry, line 2, 15.2. I do not own a muzzleloader, so I don't know all about muzzleloaders. Although I went to a muzzleloader school last night to learn how to operate them out at Oakdale Gun Club. A flint or percussion cap or musket cap. Representative Hoppe, I think you know a bit about this. Does that mean some of the muzzleloaders that I saw last night, as I understood it from a distance, use a 209 primer for ignition, the same kind of a primer as a shotgun shell. Now, would that prohibit the way this is done, language is written? And I understand, I believe that they still use gunpowder, which explodes rather than burns. Would that line prohibit the use of a 15.2... Representative Hackbart, would that prohibit the use of a gun that used a primer, a shotgun-style primer, that language?
And we're referring to page 15, line 1 and 2.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Dill, that was not my amendment. I don't know.
Oh, I thought that was your...
No, mine was the smokeless gunpowder one, but it's a good question.
Representative McNamara?
Mr. Chair, Representative Dill... I misunderstood your question, too. We're not dealing with the smokeless powder. I thought that was... Is that your question about the smokeless powder and the tablets that we use in our inline muzzle loaders?
No, Mr. Chair.
Representative.
Again, I don't know that much about these things, but I saw a muzzle loader last night that I believed was using black powder, and then it used a 209 they were using a 209 Winchester primer. It was a break-open style of a gun, and they put a primer in front of the hammer. But yet they were loading it with black powder tablets from the muzzle end. And so when I read this language on line 15.2 of the bill, I saw flint, percussion cap, or musket cap, and I was wondering, did any of those items listed in this line cover that type of an ignition system, a primer ignition system?
Mr. Chairman, maybe Mr. Bogus can answer that question, and then please come back to me.
Okay. Bogus?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Dill, my understanding is that this amendment was intended to not allow for the 209 shotgun primer type of ignition that's in the inline, commonly used in inline, but this was for the traditional flintlock and percussion cap muzzle loaders.
And Mr. Chairman and Representative Dill, the reason this language is here is because we're continually dealing with this issue of muzzleloader season, a special muzzleloader season, and that's fine, and that's not a problem. But the special muzzleloader season was originally there for the old-fashioned type flintlock folks, and which were also called the muzzleloaders. I mean, they had muzzleloaders. But now the technology has advanced so much on these muzzleloaders, and that's fine. But now we're talking about putting scopes on muzzleloaders, and I think that goes one step beyond why we have a special muzzleloader season. The language that's here now is to get back to the old traditional muzzleloader type season, rather than with the new technology we have and putting scopes on these things. I don't think that was the intent of the season. We can hunt right now with muzzleloaders and scopes during the regular firearm season, and that's fine. And if folks want to do that, that's perfectly allowable. But the special muzzleloader season was for the old-style technology that was the flintlock, percussion cap, musket cap type rifles. So that's why this is here, to more or less kind of counteract the fact that we're continually dealing with the scopes on muzzleloaders.
Mr. Chair. So I'm sensing then that this language, I didn't hear you say anything about not really liking the 209 primer ignition system. I'm sensing that this is in here for a future negotiation.
That's correct.
Oh, I've read between the lines then. I am happy with that answer. Thank you.
Okay, any other questions on the bill? Okay, we'll go to amendments. We have... I guess I'm offering an amendment. It's the A-19 amendment. And we could have Sarah Pesek come up and speak to this, or Representative McNamara?
Well, Mr. Chair, I think Mr. Bosick and I have been working with Ms. Pisick, so if you want Mr. Bogus just to run through it real quickly, it's just to address the boat manufacturers' concerns if we would permanently close some waters, that there would be a public hearing, and it seems like all parties are in agreement on it. We need to run it by the commissioner's office just before it gets to the floor, but it seems like it makes sense.
Okay. This is asking for a public hearing before they make the decision. Okay.
Mr. Chair, is this A-19, did you say?
A-19.
Okay. I misplaced it.
It's referring to when they're prohibiting motorized watercraft on a water body.
Do I like it?
They'd have to have a public hearing before they make that decision.
Okay. Good amendment.
That's the essential.
But I like it.
Okay. Any questions on the amendment? All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevailed. A-19 amendment is passed. Representative Hackford has an amendment. It has the words spring turkey season. Representative Hackford.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. National Wild Turkey Federation brought this language to me. Right now, the turkey season, spring turkey season, you can only hunt until 5 p.m. This has changed over the years. It was noon, and it dropped down, and now we're at 5 o'clock. I believe that making it sunset
which this amendment does, is probably the right thing to do. National Wild Turkey Federation, Mr. Tom Glines, brought this language to me, and they would like to put this in statute. I don't know if Mr. Boggess might have some comments on it.
Mr. Boggess?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hackbarth, this is something that we've been discussing in DNR. We took public comment on this very proposal this spring, and we found generally there was support from the public. This is not a biological issue. We don't have any problem with it at all from a turkey management or biological standpoint, but it has been a little bit of a social issue amongst turkey hunters and landowners. In our public input meetings this spring, 70% of the comments statewide were favorable. We did have some areas where there was less support for this, but I just have to qualify my comments in that we've not had a chance to run this after public input, run this back by the commissioner's office yet. So we still need to do that step before I could say that we're supportive of this.
And thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I told Mr. Boggess and the DNR that if the commissioner does have a problem with this, that I would have an amendment on the floor to pull it out of the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Mr. Boggess, what is the Minnesota wild turkey population approximately?
Mr. Chair and Representative Erdahl, it's difficult to put an exact number on it, but in round figures, it's in the 50 to 60,000 bird range. It's been growing. And particularly, it's been expanding the range northward. And we've got a research project going right now in northwest Minnesota to see if turkeys can survive in that part of the state. We know temperature is not a problem for turkeys, but availability of food can be with deep snow. But the population is very healthy, and it's expanding.
Representative Wiggins.
Same to Representative Erdahl asked the beginning of my question. When you're doing something like this, Representative Hackbarth, I worry, because I don't see that many wild turkeys, that maybe we need to wait 2 years to do this, just to give it the population a time to expand even more. That is my only concern here, that if we were to wait a little bit, put an effective date later, we can both educate the public and just have that many more turkeys out there.
Representative Cornish?
Representative Morginius, I think the turkey season's been around for a long time. Started out, didn't it, down in the southeast, and they've just been flourishing like rabbits. And in fact, they've been surviving in an area where they never thought really that they would survive, and they've transplanted them. Killer up now, I think they're starting a project in the northwest. And so they have shown no signs of any danger, I think, from hunting. In fact, just the opposite, having increased the permits to keep them down in some areas. So it looks like the population is really stable.
Mr. Marcus?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wagenius, in the spring we only hunt the gobblers or the male turkeys, so the hunting season really has no effect on the population, so we're not concerned that this would slow down that expansion in any way.
Okay. Representative Hill.
I agree with Representative Cornish, Mr. Chair. Even up around in the Arrowhead, there are, well, we have turkeys that have feathers and don't have feathers. And the ones with the feathers are pretty good, actually, wolf food, because it seems that they can even catch them. And so, even where we don't even really want turkeys, we've got turkeys.
Even in the legislature. the motion reoccurs on the Hackbarth Amendment. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no. Motion prevails. Amendment is passed.
Mr. Chairman, I have a question on the bill.
Representative Magnus.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a question on the bill. Page 9, line 9.2. Could you explain to me the section you're adding in $100 if a dog continuously pursues the animal? What's that mean?
Representative Magnus.
I'm trying to fix Representative Pennis's bill.
Oh, it wasn't my bill.
Representative Pennis, do you have an answer to that question?
Mr. Chair, no. Yes, I do. I'll tell you what I did. It was in the bill originally, and it read up to $500, and that was for pursuing and or killing a deer. So I worked with Colonel Hamm in trying to come up with a language that would be acceptable because, you know, if a deer, a dog takes after a deer that runs through our yard frequently, we could be fined $500. Or we would be. So this is what we come up with. For pursuing, it's $100. For killing, it's $500. Now, the caveat that I can live with that is that it is up to our conservation officer whether he issues the ticket or not. No, I feel confident with the one sitting next to me only because I'm sitting next to him. But I don't feel confident with anybody all the time. So that's my explanation.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'm trying to figure out what continuously pursues means.
Run.
How far does my dog have to chase that deer to?
If it barks twice, Mr. Representative Magnus. Representative Pennis, is there someone from enforcement? I don't see anybody from enforcement here right now. So, Bob Meyer, he's always important.
Yeah, and Mr. Chair, I was looking for someone from enforcement too, but we do have some similar but slightly different language in the other version of this bill that's moving through that says that the owner of a dog that pursues but does not kill a big game animal rather than that continuously pursues, if that helps.
Mr. Meyer, you have something to say about this? Identify yourself.
Mr. Chair, members of the record, Bob Meyer, DNR, Legislative Affairs. Representative Pennis, I think, identified what the conversations were with Colonel Hamm and also what the situation would be out in the field, that there would be some discretion on when these citations would be issued or when they wouldn't be issued. It's not going to be the dog slip the collar and is running around, you get a ticket type thing. It's going to be where there's a blatant kind of violation that the citation would be issued.
Representative Magnus?
Well, here's the situation I see. I live next to a wildlife management area on the home farm, and my wife and I walk down there. My wife walks down there virtually every night, and I hopefully can get back once in a while to walk with her, and she takes the dog with her. And, you know, a lot of times you'll have a deer will pop up, and the dumb dog is going to chase that deer, so I don't want the Gestapo arresting my wife and finding her $500 or $100 if they see her. Say the dog out there, because the dog's not going to stop, but she yells at him, stop, I'll guarantee you. So, I mean, I'm trying to keep myself out of trouble with the gal I live with.
Representative McNamara.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Magnus, under current law, your wife could be subjected to a fine up to $500. I think you probably like our language or Representative Pennis's language that she worked out with Colonel Hamm. Now your dog would have to be continuously pursuing and would only be subject to a $100 fine. So you probably like this language a lot better than current law.
Well, I don't like it, but I like it better, but I still don't like it. But I'm trying to keep myself out of trouble, Representative.
Well, Representative Magnus, we try and do that around here too, keep you out of trouble. But
I know.
I think we'll move on unless there's something else here. Representative Bennett.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And you know, I've seen enough to know when a dog is continuously pursuing, and it is an aggravated, going to kill, with intent to kill, I don't know, of the deer. And I would hope our COs know that, too. Now, it leaves it wide open, and it's hard to have complete trust in anybody, but this is better than it was, I think.
Representative Magnus, do you have anything you'd like to amend the bill with, or would you want to go ahead with this particular language?
Well, Mr. Chairman, let me get some thought to it. We'll visit with the DNR. I just hate to leave things in and have discretion of somebody. You know, If a CEO like Representative Cornish used to be is in a bad mood that day, they could have a lot of discretion on a lot of things. So I hate to have it open to discretion. So it's just a point. I'd like them to follow orders.
Representative Junkie.
Well, I have the same thoughts as Representative Genius, and I guess I don't like that language either, Representative Magnus, and I think the penalty should be for a dog that kills or injures a deer. You know, if you're chasing a deer, and our dogs have chased them too, and they come through our area, and, you know, it's one thing to chase a deer, come on, get back home, and you're after the dog, and, you know, and it's someone's dog. But if it's, you know, other dogs that are killing or injuring, you know, dropping, biting, bringing down a deer, even if it didn't kill it, then I think they should be fined.
I've been very excited about this whole thing, but we don't want to do away with the law forever. I mean, pursuing the deer actually probably kill more deer than they actually do when they catch the deer. You've got to understand that they're chasing these deer when they're laden down with fawns, and they'll abort their fawns from chasing. We have a huge problem with chasing deer. This is actually loosening up the law here. Right now you get fined $500, and they're saying here that you have to continuously pursue. But pursuing actually is a real dangerous thing for the dogs to do, and we've been, you know, we got horror stories of them killing 20-some deer over by Swan Lake in one bunch, and so we don't want to do away with the law. We're trying to compromise here and make it less of a fine and having to prove it's continually, so we're being more lenient here. We don't want to strike the language altogether.
Representative Gaines, did you have something? No.
Mr. Chairman, I like my colleagues over there's solution, and I would offer an oral amendment to delete the add on line 918, the owner of a dog that kills or pursues and injures is subject to a $500 fine, and delete the 100 on line 920. Delete the and, the words after and the words after and, $100 fine for pursuing the animal.
Mr. Allen, you have that.
So you're removing the 100?
Proposed amendment?
Yeah.
Could you read it back as you understand the amendment?
I'm not sure I do understand the amendment. Is Representative Magnus, are you taking out all the new language in 919 and 920?
Yes.
And then you're just adding and injures after pursues in line 918? Okay, then that's what it is.
I would also like to delete up to 500, leave some discretion for the officers. Good. Add back in up to 500 on line 19.
Representative McNamara.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I would oppose this amendment, as Representative Cornish has so well said, that this dog chasing of deer is a really serious problem in the deep snow situation. And for to be able to tell if the deer really gets killed or aborts its fawns or whatever, we have some real bad examples where the dogs have chased the deer, and this lets the property owners know that they're subjected to a much smaller fine than under current law. So I would hope that we would not take on this amendment.
Mr. Chair? Mr. Hoppe, Representative Hoppe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Seeing as how Colonel Hamm isn't here and we don't have his perspective on this, is this something that Representative McNamara and Representative Magnus could work out in the back smoke-filled back room between now and the time this goes to the floor and do an amendment then? Because I'm inclined to agree with Representative McNamara and be against the amendment. But
it could actually... Representative McNamara, Representative Magnus, this bill is going to Ways and Means. Could be worked out before then and accomplished at that point, if that's satisfactory to Representative Magnus.
Well, Representative Magnus, Representative,
that's you.
Mr. Chairman,
yes.
Representative Dill, I'll have Representative McNamara talk to my wife about it and see how we...
So you, Representative Magnus, withdraws his amendment.
Okay, we'll withdraw.
All right. Members, the A-20 amendment. That's an amendment that I'm offering for Representative Hansen in the policy committee on this same bill on House File 3116. We had a lively discussion about the taking of deer that were not whitetail or mule deer and reporting that to the commissioner. And there was some negotiation between I believe Mr. Bogus and enforcement regarding how long the number of days that would be allowed before that deer could be reported to the commissioner, and I think this is an agreement and that the department is okay with this, Mr. Bogus.
Mr. Chairman, yes.
So I would move, members, the A20 amendment to House File 3116 and any discussion by the members. Representative Hackbar.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And what would be, is there any penalty if they don't report this?
Representative Hackbar, not as prescribed in this.
Mr. Bogus, from your perspective, would there be any penalty?
Mr. Chair and Representative Hackbar, that's a good question. The way this is drafted, it is not codified in the game of fish laws. Mr. Helen and I were just having that conversation a little earlier, so I'm not sure that there is a penalty.
Mr. Chairman, as long as there's no penalty, I'm okay with it, but maybe we could find that out before the next committee. Put it on the bill and I'd like to know if there's any penalty connected with this.
All right. Further discussion on the A20 amendment? Being none, all in favor, aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The A20 is adopted. Okay. And any further discussion on House File 3116 before we make the motion to pass it on to Ways and Means as amended? It doesn't appear that there are. Representative McNamara, the motion reoccurs to pass this bill to Ways and Means as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion is adopted. Okay, we have another bill before us, the Hackbarth bill. It's the 3200, House File 3621 regarding the shooting center, and I think that's up in Grand Rapids. Is that right, Representative Hackbarth?
That's correct.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, I would move House File 3621, bring it before the committee, and for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill, debatable for possible inclusion. Thank you very much for the time, Mr. Chairman. I know we're stressed for time, and I have Ms. Jean Flane with us today. She's the chair of the Minnesota Support, Shooting Sports Education Center, to give her presentation, and hopefully we can wrap this up very, very quickly.
Okay. State your name for the record and introduce yourself. Go ahead with your presentation.
Sure. Honorable Chairman, representatives, and members of the committee, my name is Jean Lane, and I will quickly go through the high points. I'm not only the chair of the nonprofit board for Minnesota Shooting Sports Education Center Incorporated. I'm a parent and actively involved in both training and competitive shooting. I'm here to testify in favor of the proposed legislation regarding the Minnesota Shooting Sports Education Center. You have in front of you now probably a packet that's orange in color. Within that, first you'll see a handout that gives you a little bit of background about the Minnesota Shooting Sports Education Center. A little history. This was Governor Perkins' dream and then a goal to build this first-class facility that does education and competitive shooting. It was built in Grand Rapids and opened in April of 1999. The land and the building are owned by the state of Minnesota and through state bonding money, and there is a partnership between the Minnesota DNR and the nonprofit 501c3. The mission of the nonprofit is to provide a positive image for all shooting sports through education and world-class competition. The Minnesota Shooting Sports Education Center nonprofit is the one who operates the building. Let me go through what's currently happening over the past couple years. The nonprofit has focused on fundraising, youth programming, youth competitive shooting, networking with partners, large partners such as USA Shooting, NRA, and CMP, Civilian Marksmanship Program, and enhancing our partnership with the DNR. One of the things that we do highlight in our mission is education. You can see as part of your packet of information, there is a firearm that's listed as A. In 2004 and 2005, there was firearm safety-related courses held at the Minnesota Shooting Sports Education Center. 32 courses, 783 participants. You can see by the red stars on the map, they come from all over the state of Minnesota.
There's several quotes on the handout labeled eight. And the last one I really liked. It was from a young person, Adam. It was really fun, and I wish I could do it again. For any youth that goes through any kind of training to indicate that they want to do it again is pretty impressive. There's also in your handout a letter from a mother and a daughter who went through a firearm safety course held at the Minnesota Shooting Sports Education Center, indicating how they really did learn the gun safety. We're appreciative of that. There's an item labeled C from Julie Esterbrook, also indicating going through the training. There's a letter from the 8th grade geography teacher of how a member of the Shooting Sports Education Center staff went and spoke in front of the 8th grade. There's also letters from parents regarding competitive shooting and what it's done for their youth and the impact it's had on them, the positive impact. There's letters in your handout from students, 6th graders, that there's 3 or 4 of them that indicate what they've done in the training that they received at the center and the impact it's made upon them. In item J, you'll see an email from a competitive shooter, a pistol shooter. She's actually right now competing in the Junior Olympics at the Colorado Springs. And you can see what the impact of having the center had on her. There's also letters from our partners, from NRA, from Howard Q. Mutie, and he's a national coach trainer, an email. And he indicates in there that basically the thought process behind training and what it does. There's one thing that he points out is that the Minnesota Shooting Sports Education Center is the best facility in the country at this time for this type of training, the last paragraph. It also states that there is a national shooting sports camp that's held at the center in the summertime, representing 16 states and 36 athletes from 16 states that have traveled. Competitive shooters in Minnesota, the youth are identified in the blue stars. You can see those blue stars come from all over the state of Minnesota. There are some stars, though, that are located in Lake Superior. Well, that's because those are some foreign exchange students from Mexico, Switzerland, and Germany that also have attended our training, and also we have competitive shooters. What do we hold for the future? We want to increase youth and adult programming. We want to do more education. We want to increase our staffing so that we can have more programming. We want to stabilize our financial base and, of course, fundraise. Increase our volunteers, increase our networks and partnerships, especially with the DNR. This legislation will help us in the future provide that stable financial base. I'm going to take a breath because usually talk fast. So if there's any questions?
Yes, I do have a question. Representative Hagbar, is in our spreadsheets from last year, is there any money that DNR gives to this? We're trying to figure that out at all. Do you receive any money from DNR through our normal appropriation? I was looking for Mr. Meyer. I think he's gone.
Right. Prior to the fall of 2005, there was no state money involved in the operations of the facility. We have now received a small amount of funding to carry on the maintenance of the building since November of 2005.
And explain, what kind of annual operating budget do you have?
Annual operating budget for the center is $150,000.
All right. Any other questions by the membership? Okay, good bill. It's a great place. I just had one more question. You have no connection at all to the trap shooting facility that's next door to you?
We partner with them. Matter of fact, when the camps or the youth come in for training, we use both our Grand Rapids Gun Club, which is down the road, outdoor shooting, small bore, high power, and then right down the street from us, or down the road from us, is the gun range, and we partner with both of them.
Okay, so some of the people who come go down and shoot trap and skeet and things of that nature. Mm-hmm. And they're another nonprofit that aren't connected to you?
Right, we are a separate nonprofit.
Okay. Representative Peterson?
No.
Did you have Bill? Our question? All right, we're going to lay the Representative Hackbar.
And Mr. Chair and members, I'd also like to state that would also require non-state match money for the appropriation.
Right, I see that on line 11. All right. In no further discussion, we're going to lay the bill over for possible inclusion. Thank you very much.
Good bill, Mr.
Chairman.
Good job.
Okay, members, we're going to adjourn here just a few minutes before the deadline, and we're going to lay over the other two bills for Tuesday Ag Environment Finance Committee hearing. So with that, unless we have some other business, the meeting is adjourned.